The Guardian.
As Election Day gets closer, Theresa May gets personal.
But is the best way to stave off election nerves, and I hope you're not eating as I say this, really to picture your opponent naked?
Ooh. Meanwhile, a YouGov projection has dropped like a bombshell into this campaign. Could the Tories really be in danger of losing their majority? I'm Jonathan Friedland.
And I'm Owen Jones. And today we're delighted to welcome Stephen Bush to the pod, I'd argue one of our finest political journalists. He's political commentator on The New Statesman, also the host of a rival political podcast, but we're not tribal.
We can all agree this election is not quite panning out how we expected, at least not for those Labour MPs who only weeks ago were scanning the jobs pages and considering career changes. Today, a ray of hope, a lifeline, comes on the front page of the Times via a YouGov projection, which has stunned the political classes, I think it's fair to say, because it shows there that Theresa May could be on course, according to their projection, to lose seats and lose her parliamentary majority. So a hung parliament forecast from YouGov. We have on the line Martin Boone, who is director of The Guardian's pollster, ICM. Martin, your professional and non-rivalrous take on this projection by YouGov.
Brave, I think, is the first word that I would employ.
Brave in the Sir Humphrey sense of brave, meaning stupid.
I wouldn't quite go far to say it's stupid. I think it's an admirable contribution to the general level of understanding. And it's built on innovative techniques, which I would love to have access to myself. So I think I'm going to separate my personal admiration for what they're trying to do from the difficulties of doing it.
Can I just drill down into where your scepticism might lie? Because the underlying data says, first of all, that the Tories are just 4 points ahead of Labour, just in terms of basic polling, and then they go on to the seat projection. Which bit of that do you think they're getting wrong?
Well, you would expect me to say that they're getting the polling bit wrong, given our poll in The Guardian yesterday suggested that there was a 12-point lead. There is an interesting debate that has suddenly emerged within the polling community, with us at ICM and Comres sitting on one side of the turnout waiting conundrum, where we basically, well, I'm being a bit strong, but we don't believe people to the extent of other pollsters when they say that they are definitely going to turn out to vote. So what we've had, I think, in the last week or perhaps 10 days is a reaction to the undoubtedly populist platform presented by Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, particularly for young people with the abolition of student fees and they're being replaced by grants and other such things, which are of course appealing on a top line level and could be the clincher for actually getting young people out to vote. But let's remember, young people disproportionately and historically do not turn out to vote in anything like the kind of numbers that their older counterparts do. And whether you believe young people on polls now saying that they will when they previously said that they won't is a matter of great significance and is actually the single reason why polls like ours are saying the Tories have got a bigger lead than, for example, polls like YouGov are saying, because we're being more sceptical about our view on whether or not they will actually turn out.
Thank you, Martin Moon. Admirably clear. We're going to let you go and we'll turn to our in-house number cruncher, if you like, here in the pod, in the form of Stephen Bush, who does a whole lot of things, but looking at polls is one of them. I'm interested, Stephen, because you do travel the country, you talk to people on the doorstep. If this were right, as it were, we'd be feeling it, seeing it, you know, smelling it, political veterans always say. Are you detecting in your movements out and about this kind of move, this big shift from the Tories to Labour, which would explain these polls?
Yes, not in every part of the country I've been visiting, but in some of them. I was particularly struck by actually when I visited Wales, where according to that first YouGov poll, and that was definitely my first impression the first time I visited Wales when the election was called, a lot of people who didn't like Jeremy Corbyn were looking at Theresa May and going, oh, maybe she's a different type of Tory, this Brexit issue it means that maybe I can lend my vote to the Conservatives. And then one of the big missteps of this campaign is basically the Conservatives have reminded everyone that they are the Conservatives. She actually doesn't seem like a different type of Tory. She seems like almost a caricature of a Conservative.
With things like the dementia tax.
With the dementia tax, with the fox hunting, the ivory ban, which didn't sort of get that much pick up in the bubble, but I think did... One, people in Britain love animals. I don't really understand it myself, but I've just accepted that that is a thing about British voters. And I think all of that has contributed to some of those people who didn't like Jeremy, who were dipping their toes in the kind of water of voting Conservative, gone, oh, I don't like that. So there's definitely been some movement. And he definitely is, and I see this on my commute into work, he's definitely gobbling up the smaller anti-Conservative parties. Yeah, my journey into work before, you'd see, oh, Green, Lib Dem, Labour. And now those same posters, partially that's just churn in the private rented sector, but Labour are successfully appealing to and eating up the parties to their left. So that, to me, explains how you get Labour on 35% of the vote. That explains how you get the Tories down to 42% of the vote. The big thing that I'm very struck by is it feels to me that a lot of that Labour surge might be in deeply unhelpful places. It feels that both Labour and the Lib Dems are sort of competing in this election to work out how they can expand their vote in the least useful places. Yeah, there are people in Islington, in Hornsey, in Bermondsey, in Old Southwark, who are very upset about Labour's Article 50 statement. But there aren't very many of them, and there are huge Labour majorities there. There are people in Cornwall and Bath who are saying, actually, I'm going to vote Labour this time because he's appealing to that anti-system feeling that the Lib Dems used to tap into. But Labour are so far off the pace in Bath, that's not much use to them under first past the post. So I realise I'm going to say the reverse of Martin, who I think makes a persuasive case about how you feel all about turnout does hinge out. But I could believe YouGov's numbers. But it just feels to me like those votes probably aren't in the right place.
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to put my Angel of Doom cap on, for those of us who want Labour to succeed, Labour's field operations apparently privately believe that, and they process the doorstep data, if you like, of those canvassers knocking on doors, that the Tories have a 12 to 15 point lead. That's their own private estimate. But then again, I mean, just as an example, today Theresa May is campaigning in Plymouth, Sutton and Devonport. That's a seat that went Tory in 2010, had a small swing to Labour in 2015, and only has a majority of 523. Bear in mind, when she kick-started this, she was doing events in...
Halifax and
places. Well, with a 12,000 majorities, which was just showed the scale of their ambition. But I suppose it's that point, isn't it, about where the votes pile up? Because as an example, I went to Ealing on Sunday. Rupert Hook, the candidate, Labour candidate there, only has a very, very small majority, about 150. The Tories are privately very despondent about that seat. They don't think they're going to take it. But equally, I've gone to, for example, in the Midlands, seats where Labour has an 8,000 majority, but because of the UKIP collapse and a very sizable UKIP vote there, the Labour candidates are very, very depressed indeed and don't think they're going to win. It's one of the, you know, great mysteries of this election. We'll see what happens. Could it be the case that seats which Labour have a small majority in, they're going to increase that majority depending on where they are, and others where Labour have a very sizable majority are the ones that are in real danger?
Which would be a real twist on what usually happens in elections, but it goes to what you, Stephen, were saying, which is the idea that what Corbyn does is he solidifies your votes in those metro areas, perhaps among students, university towns, etc. So where Labour was doing okay, they do even better, but it doesn't actually advance you in areas which is how you win elections, which is taking seats off the other side.
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing about the local elections, which are obviously a very bad performance for Labour and the Liberal Democrats, now mostly when they adjust for the local factors, they get about the right vote share. But one of the things which did clearly happen there is Labour were doing very well in real cities. I'm going to offend all of your listeners from, you know, places like, you know, kind of Manchester is a real city. Salford, I'm afraid, is just not, right? You know, ditto Newcastle.
He said it. We didn't say it. Owen didn't say it.
Those complaints will be ditto, like, flying.
That's
ditto
the new Stephen Bush of the New Statesman. The New Statesman Stephen Bush making that point.
Yeah, do look up his email address.
But that was the interesting thing about the EU referendum. It was the revenge of the small city against its bigger neighbour. And what looked to be happening in the local elections was Labour doing very well in cities and dissolving in towns and pseudo cities. He said doubling down on his offence. But and again, that wouldn't have been picked up in the local elections. That might explain the very different noises, because I, like Owen, hearing Yeah, Conservatives saying, oh, we're done in this place. And they clearly are worried. And you then have Labour...
Right, in Kemptown being one example where the Tories won it last time, but they are very, very nervous, the Tories. They think they're going to lose it.
And that all of that would fit together with a Labour coalition looking a lot, actually, like Barack Obama's, but unfortunately in a country with 1970s US demographics, fewer graduates, fewer ethnic minorities, fewer small L liberals. Yeah, kind of Labour winning the future, but struggling to break through in the present.
And this is where, I mean, this generational divide, which is astronomical. The ICM poll yesterday, we've just had ICM on, obviously, had, you know, this astonishing, yawning chasm between the two. But in London, the median age in inner London is much lower. It'll be in seats with that much higher median age where perhaps Labour will struggle. The big dividing issue now is generation, not class.
Yeah, exactly. And the fascinating thing about the aging is that has never happened in any other sort of peak result, right? The 1983 Conservative landslide, they won every age group. 1997 Labour landslide, they won every age group. If ICM is right, and actually even if the sort of polls showing better results for Labour, that won't happen this time. For the first time, a party will win a landslide in some age demographics and be crushed in another. That is a new type of politics. And the big question is that a cohort effect? Will the people who are younger now voting Labour continue to do so, or will they become Conservative later on? My instinct is it is actually a political realignment. It's not just the younger, more left-wing. It's a permanent shift.
The last thought we'll have to wind up this topic is whether or not the polling itself begins to then have an effect. You know, the old Heisenberg uncertainty principle that something changes by being observed. Last time, in 2015, the very fact that the polls appeared to tighten and Labour were with a shout and there could have been a hung parliament began to actually take votes away off Labour because the Tories were able to say, look, there's going to be an Ed Miliband SNP coalition. And in this final week, I wonder if that, the sheer tightness of the polls becomes a factor. It's perhaps possible. Well, you can leave us your thoughts on our podcast page and follow tonight's TV debate on our election live blog at theguardian.com.
So, before we move on, we've got quite an interesting question in from listener Sam Crossman. He says, it'd be great to go into detail about policies like nationalisation, which sounds like a car crash waiting to happen. From everything I've read, we'd be worse off. Plus, where are the successful examples of closer state control? Cuba, Russia. He also gently chides us for being too biased in favour of Labour. I should probably point out, you know, this is a left of centre broadsheet newspaper and anti-Labour press coverage, well, you're more than catered for. But just quickly on public ownership, I'd say, you know, there's a sliding scale, isn't there, between a total command economy and public ownership of various utilities. There are many examples of successful European economies which you have public ownership of rail, of energy, of other utilities. What Labour are proposing with rail is as each franchise expires, they'd be brought into public ownership. We did that with East Coast Railway as a country, and that became the most efficient rail franchise. With energy, to follow the German model, local public ownership. And with water, where you swap shares for government bonds and then get the revenue stream from water. So that's my own thoughts on it.
And I think, I wonder rather, if this is also one of those generational topics where, you know, we've noted here on the podcast, I think that the Tories are going hard, were going hard on the question of Jeremy Corbyn's sympathies for the IRA in the past, and finding that for younger voters, it was like, who are the IRA? Didn't really penetrate. And I just wonder if nationalisation as a kind of boo word is true for people of, you know, who remember the 70s or whatever, when it did become a kind of toxic word in the public conversation. And now don't think of it as Sam Crossman does, you know, linking it in his mind with Cuba and the Soviet Union, but instead just think, we've seen what private provision is like. We know, as you said, Owen, that, you know, on continental Europe, the big transport and mass utilities are often in public ownership. What's the big deal? I wonder, Stephen, if you think that there is a generational dimension to this, or anyway, what you think about nationalisation.
I mean, the interesting thing about a lot of these generational polls is actually they lag slightly the voting intention. And I'm curious as to the extent to which older voters go, I don't like Jeremy Corbyn, therefore I think he probably has questions to answer over the IRA. And younger voters go, I do like Jeremy Corbyn, therefore I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure to what extent.
Chicken or egg.
What is wagging the dog there? But I think on nationalisation, maybe it's partially generational, but personally, to be honest, it's not an issue I have religion on one way or the other. For say something like buses, it feels to me open and shut. We would like more people to take them. at the moment, the only way you'd do that would be for them to be massively loss-making. Therefore, it probably makes sense, at least in the medium term, for the government to run more bus services so you can wean people off cars.
Or local authorities like Nottingham.
Yeah, or local authorities. Yeah, so you can wean people off cars, you can provide them more regularly, you don't need to worry about the fact you're servicing lower-income areas, etc., etc. There are just so many delivery arguments for it. But there's not... The whole point of sort of Cuba or one of the other countries is you're running the kind of profit-making bits of the economy, whereas the whole point of a mixed economy is that you accept that there are some things that the state runs. I mean, we've nationalized a bank for some time and we have not moved noticeably closer to Venezuela. It just feels there are lots of critiques to be had of nationalization, but
just quickly on age, it's interesting because the polling suggests middle-aged Britons are more likely to support railway nationalization than younger Britons. So it's interesting. But anyway, let's move on. What I want to talk about is the issue of immigration. Now, this was a big issue in the 2010 and 2015 general elections in particular. This was supposed to be the Brexit election, as we know. It hasn't quite panned out as Theresa May hoped in that sense. But there's an interesting change of tack this morning if you look at the front pages of the right-wing press. Now, the Tories tried to go in hard, the Tory press, on the issue of the IRA. Jeremy Corbyn would say very passionately that he spoke to Republicans in the 1980s because he wanted a peace process, which is obviously what we ended up with. Now, privately, apparently, the Tories are despondent about the fact that the IRA line isn't cutting through. So if you look at the front pages today, it looks pretty coordinated, if you were to be cynical. The Daily Mail, Labour's plan to open doors to Britain even wider. The Daily Express, migrant summer chaos. And the Daily Telegraph, Labour's secret plan to increase migration, which does make one arch one's eyebrow. But nonetheless, is this going to cut through? How much of an issue is immigration on the doorstep? Will this divide Labour's coalition as it's done traditionally? What do you think, Stephen, in this election?
I'm struck by the fact that I think a lot of people think that by voting for Brexit, the immigration is going to go down. And I'm really struck by the people who, they might think there's too much immigration now. And I think one of the mistakes that Theresa May and the political class is making is when they talk about immigration falling, they talk about people in the future. I think there is a large group of people in the country who thinks that means that some people are going to leave. And I think if Brexit turns out badly, which if Theresa May wins feels quite likely to me, disappointment and anger is going to be channeled towards recent migrant communities and in some cases established second and third generation migrant communities. But I just feel that the sting has been taken out of it a bit by the fact we've left and we have taken control, and immigration will, I think, in a lot of people's minds reduce. But I could be wrong.
I think that explains why they haven't done it till now. The idea that was in the box you marked sort of done and sorted, and in a way Brexit, and we talked about it on the podcast yesterday, why Brexit has not been an issue in the supposed Brexit election is because of that sense that we decided that, we sorted that out. Nevertheless, you can see why they would do it, because it's home turf for her as the Home Secretary. We would obviously immediately point out that she promised again and again and again to bring down numbers into the tens of thousands and it didn't happen, but it's a natural bit of turf for her. It also must discomfort Jeremy Corbyn. It's not an easy issue for him. It wasn't an easy issue for Ed Miliband. On the one hand, he has to say, and he did say, free movement is over and migrant numbers will probably come down. But that's not something that comes naturally to him. It's not an outcome I think he's particularly pleased at. He's somebody who believes in free movement. It's something admirable about him that he does. And yet, one thing interesting is he doesn't get much flack or pushback from the left on that. When Ed Miliband put out the mug, Controls on Immigration, there were howls of protest. He, Jeremy Corbyn, on a sort of Nixon to China principle, is allowed to say to Jeremy Paxman on Monday night, yeah, probably come down, no problem. Free movement's over, get used to it. So he has room and space. But nevertheless, it's not natural comfort zone for him. And I can see why the Tories would like to remind people of that and say, if you want immigration down, you're safer with us.
I think the difficulty, though, is the reason why Jeremy has that space is no one believes him. I mean, I didn't really believe Ed when he would say that. But the reason why whenever Yvette Cooper or Tom Watson or Ed Balls would go, immigration is too high, or Rachel Reeves would do it, I'd get very irritable, is I actually did kind of feel they sort of believed it and might try and carry it through. When Jeremy says, immigration will go down, I just think, I don't believe for a moment that you think that this...
And that's a positive for you, as somebody who believes in immigration. But I'm saying for the people in the country who are anti more immigration, that lack of credibility. That
yeah, and that,
at the same instinct you've got, which is they don't believe him when he says it, is a problem.
Yeah, and I think you're completely right. And I think that the reason why he's able to move Labour's rhetorical position without people getting angry is probably why, if immigration is an issue in this election, people don't think it's been settled by the Brexit vote. It doesn't really matter what it is that he says on it, because, you know, I don't actually really like what's written in the Labour manifesto on immigration, but my assumption is that Jeremy Corbyn would oversee a more humane and actually, weirdly, more pro-business immigration policy than the Tories. And there is basically nothing he could say to me to make me believe that under Jeremy Corbyn it will be harder and more unpleasant to come here.
I mean, this is, in terms of the fissures within Labour's coalition, its natural electoral coalition, this is the one the Tories are often keenest to exploit, because if we look, it's the Hackney versus Hull issue, I suppose, isn't it? Both Hackney and Hull are Labour heartlands, and both... I don't want to caricature people, because you know, you get people in Hull who probably are relatively positive about immigration. I'm sure you'll meet people in Hackney who are less so. But nonetheless, there is a difference in worldview, in values, which you will find often amongst Labour voters in places like Hackney and Hull. Particularly younger voters, again, I don't want to caricature the generations here, but amongst younger people who tend to live in more ethnically diverse communities, they tend to be more positive about immigration. In amongst older, particularly skilled, semi-skilled, unskilled working class backgrounds, less so. And they're the ones UKIP have tried to obviously win over, and those are some of the people now defecting to the Conservatives, aren't they?
Yeah, that is exactly right. And I think your summary is entirely fair of the problem. Under Ed, they basically hit on quite a good strategy to holding on to their vote, which was to irritate everyone a little bit. What may happen, and it seems to me that's quite likely behind the surge in the polls, is that Jeremy appeals more to people like me and less to people who are not as pro-immigration, less into diversity, etc., etc. The difficulty is that losing in the present, winning in the future difficulty, right? At some point, if you wait long enough, that coalition is big enough to win. But unfortunately, if you wait long enough, the Conservatives have been in power for 40 years.
That's right. I mean, I would say that maybe I'd refine Owen's distinction between Hackney and Hull and offer sort of Manchester and Morley, say, so that you have cities that are comfortable with immigration, and maybe even parts of Hull would be in that category. Versus small towns that are not. So Morley and Outwood, Ed Balls' seat, and it famously lost his seat because Labour voters went over to UKIP. I think the question is, and the reason why they bring up immigration, we've talked about it here today, is those UKIP voters. That vote is melting away. How's it going to break? Does it go almost entirely over to the Tories, or does some stay with Labour? And a decisive factor, surely, for a lot of those one-time Labour voters who went to UKIP must be immigration. And if they worry that Labour is soft on immigration somehow, as they would see it, that may mean they're definitely going to leave UKIP, but they go to Theresa May rather than Jeremy Corbyn. So I think going for immigration in this final week, given the campaign they've had, makes some sense from the Tories' point of view.
Now, we are almost out of time, but you can follow us on Twitter, at Guardian Podcasts. Stephen is at Stephen KB. I'm Owen Jones, 84, and Johnny is at Friedland.
But before we go, as always, a quick bit of recommended reading, and we'll link to all the pieces that we mention on our podcast page. For me, today's recommended read is in our own beloved Guardian. It is by our beloved colleague, Raphael Baer, who gets into this point about the Brexit election that never was and how this really isn't, and makes the really astute point that this idea of no deal, and this has become a very effective slogan for Theresa May, no deal is better than a bad deal. No deal is really non-existent. It's not an option. If anything, it is just the worst kind of bad deal. As he puts it, no deal is the last stop on the bad deal train. And he explains why all the sort of just technically instant negative ramifications of walking away from the table with no deal.
My piece is by Jerry Hassan in the Guardian opinion pages. His is "The SNP and Tories Have Swapped Places in Scotland." So it's about the strange rebirth of conservative Scotland, whereby, if you like, the Tories in Scotland, he argues, have become the insurgent protesters. The SNP have become, of course, the establishment in power for 10 years, his argument. And you can see there Ruth Davidson, for a Tory politician in Scotland, astonishingly popular. But it is interesting. I think one of Labour's problems is, if you are constitutionally conservative, but on economics more radical, in Scotland, that's a relatively niche political position. So those who are most fearful of the union being dissolved are now going to the Conservative Party. Those who tend to be more left of centre on economic issues and probably more predisposed to independence, of course, going to the SNP. So the Labour on an unhappy squeeze position.
Your recommended read, Stephen Bush?
Is by Katie Balls in the Eye. Whoever wins, Theresa May will lose. I think it's a really good insight into the view among the Conservative Party that whatever happens, obviously, if she loses for obvious reasons. But even now, a very big majority will be seen as 1-1 because of the Labour Party, instead of her mandate to reshape the Conservative Party, which is, of course, what she wanted.
And she will come out weaker. I think before we go, we should explain our little reference to nakedness right at the very top. Theresa May did say about, imagine Jeremy Corbyn alone and naked in the negotiations. It was a historical reference that not everyone got. Owen, enlighten our listeners.
So Nye Bevan, obviously the founder of the NHS most famously, but also in the 1950s became the icon of the Labour left, the Bevan. Now, he, right before he died, upset many of his erstwhile followers because he turned on his previous support for nuclear disarmament, unilateral nuclear disarmament, and as Shadow Foreign Secretary told Labour Conference...
I can't go naked into the negotiating chamber.
Yeah, I can't go naked into the negotiating chamber, and that upset people. Nonetheless, if Jeremy Corbyn had described Theresa May as naked and alone, regardless of what political reference he was referring to, I think there would be quite a lot of outrage and uproar myself.
I think that you're right. That is it for today. Make sure you're subscribed to Election Daily wherever you get your podcasts. We're back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.